Welcome to the Sourdoughs Speak, the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services, in cooperation with Alaska Communication Arts, brings you this series of discussions about the history and development of the Great Valleys of Interior Alaska, the Yukon, and the Tanana, and the city of Fairbanks, which developed with the coming of miners during the Great Gold Stampedes at the turn of the century. In this series, the Sourdoughs Speak, pioneer Alaskans tell you their stories about their lives as they saw and played a part in the unfolding story of Alaskan growth. Now here is your host for this series, Neville Jacobs.
Today, we'll learn about the ways of a mining camp, how it came to be, and what it was like during its heyday. The town we're talking about is Livengood. Livengood is a quiet assemblage of cabins scattered along a creek, surrounded by rolling hills about 80 miles from Fairbanks. It's on the Elliott Highway and a stop on the proposed highway to Prudhoe Bay and the Arctic Slope. The Sourdough Speak today brings you the story of Livengood in an interview with pioneer Alaskan Bill Estorff. Bill mined in the 40 Mile Country and the Bonnefield region, but he is best known as a miner from Livengood, though he still operates a mine in the summer with his wife, Thelma. Bill came to Alaska from his home state, Virginia, in 1921. Following his army discharge at the end of World War I, Bill roamed the country for 3 years. Finally, he decided his fortunes might lie in the new land of Alaska. But here is Bill Estorff to tell you about his earliest years in Alaska, from the time when he hopped a ship at Seattle and sailed to...
to Valdez and walked from Valdez into Fairbanks on the old trail, on the old dirt road, you know, see. And, I went prospecting with an old Irishman by the name of Mike Minton, because he's passed away several years ago. And, we was all up on the Salt Jacket River there for, that's the Salt Jacket, we used to call it the Salt Jacket River, see. And the little Indian camp at the mouth there, they call Munson's, at the bridge there. That's all changed now, and that's all washed out, and they got new bridging down below. And we went up there prospecting up there, we went panning along on the bars. But the Salcher River is where I went first.
Livengood was in full operation when Bill went there to mine. He was already ranked as an old-timer, and he knew the men who had made the first strike. So he's well qualified to tell about this famous mining camp and how it came into being.
I went there with old Nick Mandy. He's at the home now. I was up on the Bonnefield country. That's way out the other way, you know, see. So there used to be, at first there used to be two Hudsons. They used to call the Hudson brothers, you know, see. Jim Hudson and Ted Hudson. And then later on, when they found Livengood, they brought another brother in by the name of Cliff Hudson. See, and then they mined over there at Livengood, see. Well, that was long before my time. They were all mining at this time on Esther, on Quartz. Jay Livengood and Mike Biglow and Cascading. And Jim and Ted, they were all in together. They were mining hard rock, see. And at that time, a geologist came through the name of Brooks. And he stayed overnight with him, see. Now, this is Jim's story, see. They told me, stayed overnight with him. And told him, he looked at what they had there. Well, you haven't got anything here. So you go over in the Tolavana, and over there you'll find, there's good prospects over there, and you'll find gold over there, see. And so Livengood and Jim Hudson went over there together, you see. And they prospected all along there, and the withdrawals coming down. And they named the withdrawals after their women folks. See, there's Lillian, there's Amy, there's Ruth, you see, and there's Olive. See, they were named after their women folks, you know, see. And that's how they've got all girls' names over there. Except in the creek I'm way up ahead, and that's Lucky Creek. But that was found later, you see. And so they prospected over there. They had an old mule, and they went over there, and they prospected over there, you know. And they found some good prospects in these drawers, you see. So and they came back in, and of course that started a stampede over there. And there were several, oh, 100 people, or maybe 150 people, went over during that stampede over in that area, see. And that's quite a little town. And so they called it Brooks after this old geologist. But it's a town down the Tanana, down the river, by the name of Brooks, another little village down the name of Brooks. And the mail got mixed up, so they switched that over, called a meeting, and they called it Livingwood after old Jay, you see. And then later on, during the stampede over there, Pat O'Connor, Peterson, Ernie Peterson, and several others over there, you know, and they were too late to get in on the creek claim, so they staked up on the bench, you know, and they pitched a tent up there. Well, they said, we got a pile of grub here, and we just want to sink a hole here. And so they put a prospect hole down and they hit the main pay, the best part of it, see, that was on the leitrim. And they hit the best pay right there up on the bench up high. And then that really started to stampede over there, see? And they were mining there for several years until I went over there, you see? And we worked underground, and we paid the miners, the people worked for there, was $5 a day, room and board. And then it was open cutting in the drawers. So that was quite a little camp, and there's all this. The leitrim, one claim alone, produced over $1 million. It was over $1 million between the leitrim and this other one that joins it there. And, yeah, within two claims. Just for two claims, and there were several claims there, you know, see. And sometimes that pay streak would narrow up, and sometimes it would widen out, you know. And the way we used to do that, why, another fellow there, well, we wasn't doing anything during the winter, and well, let's go and put down a prospect hole up above up here, and we'd take a lease on that claim, and we'd put down a prospect hole there, and we'd find pay there. Well, then we'd open this up, you know, put down a working shaft and run our tunnels, and then we'd put on a bunch of men, five-wheelers down there, you know, to wheel the dirt out, two-point men. Point men is the one that did the steaming. See, we fired with a boiler.
Even when you're underground?
Underground, we fired up on top with a boiler, see, a large boiler. And with a hoist there, and we drove points, what we call points is tempered pipe, you know, see, and like steel points, we call them. And we'd drive them in, and then we'd pull those out and put sweaters in, and that'd be pipe, 3/8 pipe in there, you know, and just let the steam go slow underneath, and we'd throw the ground out, see. And,
well, now, what time of year would you do this?
Oh, you used to do summer and winter, anything, all year round, you see, and then we'd hoist all that dirt. That'd be just the state pay dirt that we're handling, you see. And of course, they had miners then, you know, we had to do our own timbering and watch out for slabbing overhead, you know, and you had to know what you were doing. But most of those people at that time were all nationalities, yeah. They were Swedes. Now, they, although they were that, they were very smart people. Now, don't get me wrong on that, because there was Carl Frisco and Teddy Frisco. Carl was the captain on his own boat on one of those old windjammers, you know, see. And Teddy was his mate, first mate, and they got shipwrecked somewhere out here on the coast, you know, and then they decided to come into Alaska and prospect in there. And then there was a lot of them. Now, Eddie Brown, down at West Fork there, his brother, was Mayor Brown in Seattle. And then there was another fellow by the name of Lynott, and his brother's a big doctor outside. Okay. So they were, well, we had all nationalities. We had Germans there, Italians, Swedes, Norwegians, even one Jap was doing cooking. A Russian, Montenegrins, and all nationality, but still it was just like one big family, you know, see. And they were all good-hearted people, you know, rough and tough, you know, and fight at the drop of the cap, you know. Next minute they'd be in there drinking this moonshine that they'd made, you know, and just as friendly as could be. For instance, I was mining up there on the Sunny Etna, a claim called upon to get the crew of men there. And Mrs. Walker, Ma Walker, we used to call her, she used to cook for me, see. And I'd say to the boys, well, I'd say, I was a dance last night. They'd have dancing down there, you see. They had a community hall, and they'd have dancing down. All pretty quiet. No fights. Yeah. Pretty quiet. Well, they'd go down there again on a Saturday evening, you know, and they'd walk down with gum boots. They'd dance all night, and nearly all Sunday, too, you know, steady dancing, you know, these old Scottish dances and old-time waltzes and different kinds of step, two-step. And they'd be having quite a time there. And this Ma Walker, she'd dance all night and all next day, and in the morning she'd have breakfast ready for the men. You see. And so anyhow, I asked them the next time, I said, well, how was the dance? Oh, good dance. Said, lots of fun. Oh, yeah. I said, how many fights? Oh, about 8 fights. So that was a good dance. But they never really hurt one another, you know. But that used to be the liveliest time in life. Well, at that time when I was there was Lala Hudson was there, Mrs. C.W. Hudson, Mrs. Van Fall, and there were several there before I went, left, you know, see. But they were all married people, I think.
Yeah.
And then we used to, the women there used to fix feeds, you know, on certain days, like the 4th of July, or that was a joke, the 4th of July. They always started on the 2nd, they couldn't wait till the 4th, and wound up about the 15th. Well, about that time, July was generally a dry season. There wasn't any water there, you know, see. It was generally a dry season then, you see, and then later on, while we get the rain, you see.
So, how did you get your supplies in?
Well, we had the road commission at that time, first of all, used to come up by boat to the logjam, see. And they couldn't get past this big logjam. There was a bunch of logs there, and they couldn't get past that. So the road commission put in what we term a tramway. And we had an old Dodge car with rims on it, you see, iron rims on it. And they laid ties, and they nailed 2x6s on these ties. And these rims would just fit inside of these ties. And there'd be 3 or 4 trailers on behind it. And the fellow that used to run that was old Dave Kramer, see? And the road commission used to pay him wages for running it. And he would go down to the log jam, and he'd put all our supplies on these. And our mail used to come in that way, too, in the summer, you see. And I was on that thing when I went in there. I walked in several times. I went in there one summer with old Dave on it. There's no brakes on that, you know, and you go down some pretty steep hills, you know, and those trailers right behind you, and sometimes you'd be off 100 feet off in the off the track, you know, in the brush there, and we'd all go down and put it back on again, you know, get out of the way it's going. That's a wooden track, see, on top of ties, you see, they cut ties and lay them down, they put these 2x6s down, see. And in the winter time, we used to come through there with a team of horses, you know, see, and well, that's mostly done in the spring of the year, you see. That's when they used to do all the freighting, have horses pull the stuff in from Dunbar. So go to Dunbar by rail, by the railroad, you know. And then from there on, we'd load all this stuff on the teams and on the sleds. Then the horses used to pull that in, see. And then they'd stop at Chattanooga River there, at Leiden's place, Chattanooga's roadhouse there. And then from there, we'd go on over to to another place right there, John Wigger had a big barn and kind of a roadhouse place there, and stopped there, and then from then, we'd go on up to West Fork, where Eddie Brown was, and then from there, we'd go on into Langdon, and those horses used to pull the sleds right along from that, and deep snow, and sometimes they had snowshoes on the horses. Yeah, you see, the snowshoes that they put on the horses was kind of a round thing that was wired across it like that. It was kind of probably about a foot in diameter all the way around. It'd be about a foot in diameter. And they'd tie them on the horses' feet, and the horses used to walk with those. And they get so used to walking around, they'd walk on that. And then we'd pour all the stuff into lighting it that way. And a lot of us, you know, we'd make out our orders for this stuff. And It'll all be brought in.
Joe, how long did you live at
Lightning's at Offshore? Well, Offshore, I was over there, went over there, and then I came back into Fairbanks, stayed in winter in Fairbanks, and went back over and stayed over there right to World War II, about 20 years.
Many of the stories the old-timers tell are about cross-country trips, about a time when there were few airplanes, fewer roads, and the only snow machine was your dog sled or your own 2 feet. On these trips, anything was likely to happen or mishappen. We asked Bill how people traveled overland in those days, especially in the summer when they couldn't use a dog sled.
Well, we put packs on the dogs, you see. It would take about, from anywhere between 50 and 30 pounds on the dogs on each side. See, there'd be a pocket on the kind of a saddle, you see. And the dogs would walk right along with that. Well, I was going over in the Beaver, along the Beaver that way, and all of a sudden, I heard like a bunch of Malamutes howling up in the draw, you know, see. And I said to my partner, there must be a trapper up there. And he said, yeah, I guess so. And as we're going along, the dogs kept huddling close to our feet. And it was wolves howling up in there, just like our dogs, you know. My dogs started huddling up next to our feet like that. And the wolves go right after the dog.
How many dogs would you have?
Oh, 5 or 6.
We asked Bill what kind of food and provisions he would carry for a cross-country trip.
Like rice or something like that. We put in rice and usually flour packed ourselves because that would get wet, you know. And, there was always enough fish in the creek, you know, to feed your dogs. And there was always plenty of game at that time. But
how about the sourdough pot?
Oh, sourdough pot, that's really... all that sourdough, but we never took it with us. So we used to mix up baking powder and flour, a little sugar and salt in with it, you know, because that's, and then have that all mixed up with it in the sack and shake that all up like it mixed up, and then we'd make bannocks. That's what we used on the trail, you see, because the sourdough pot, you know, be spilling, and the time you got it working good again, you know, you'd be on the move again. So we kept everything dry as much as possible.
You
would pack bacon, yeah. Pack bacon and flour and sometimes rice. And there's one time where I can't help laughing. The day was over in that part of the country, in that deeper part of the country, when we was cooking up some rice, you know, it was raining, and we notched out a couple of big trees and sprung another spruce tree, you know, in the notches, that's right, and then we kept spruce trees down, you know, these small trees. And we put the butts up, you know, and slope them down this way, and then we get inside and trim it down inside, knock the limbs off inside, and then patch on the outside, like thatching on the outside. And you get underneath it, and not a drop of water would come in. You lay in there, and you're just as dry as could be. We put spruce boughs down, just put them in like this, and keep them on this way, and then come back this way and get about that height. And it's better laying on a spring mattress. I know, coming down the Beavers that way there, we made one camp there that night, and it turned real foggy, and we was going up towards that Anvil Mountain, you know, and that we used to call it Anvil Mountain. They changed a lot of names, you know, and we used to go head right up to there, and then follow a caribou trail along the ridge, you know, and drop down to where Two-Step Louie was, you see. So we walked all that day. And getting towards dark, yeah, well, we decided to make a camp, you know. Still foggy, you know, fine rain, you couldn't see very far in front of you. So we decided to make camp there. And our partner, he said he'd boil up some water for tea, you know. And yes, we took tea, didn't bother with coffee on the trail, mostly tea. And I looked back that way and I heard water running over here, back behind me. And I went back over there, and by golly, I saw right where we camped that night. We'd made a big bend in the river like that and come right around this way. We walked all day and tired with big packs. If we'd have cut straight across, we'd have made it in half an hour left. That's a big loop there on the Beaver. And I said, you don't have to monkey around with too much camp. I said, we can stay where we stayed last night. He said, I'm not going to walk back that far again to make camp over there. I said, well, come on with me. And we were catching fish. And I heard the water run. I thought it'd be a good place to go over there to catch that fish. And there I saw where we had that lean-to. We did lose a day of travel. Yeah. And it cleared up. later on, then we took right across country and headed towards that mountain. See, we'd always watch these mountains, you know, these pinnacles and sitting marks. We followed the river this time, you see, because we didn't want to get tangled on up in that thick fog.
Did you ever use a compass?
Yes, but it's a lot different, you know. You can't use a compass that way, like, no. We never monkeyed with him. You know, when you're traveling that way, you see certain things, and it just comes natural to you. Yeah, it'll come natural to you, you know, just where you were at, you know, just. And I've walked from here, came to the head of 40 miles, you know, several days there. And I never used a compass that way. I knew where I was going, you know. I could see the sun and the stars, you know, and knew just about where I was traveling.
When you use dogs for travel in summer and winter, for mushing and packing, and for companionship, your dogs can become an important part of your life. Bill tells us about some of his dogs, and one that was special in the true tradition of the Northern sled dog leader. But here's Bill.
And I had one, no fence would hold him, or no chain would hold him. Because he'd break a chain, and then he'd jump a fence. I called this dog, he came with me that way then. I always had three good lead dogs that I trained to lead. And I had one of the three-quarter wolf and Van Bibber in the early days up here. But Van Bibber had five wolves that he bought, pups, that dug out of a den. And we were going to cross them with them big dogs that we had, see, that they wouldn't cross. And only in a certain time of year, that's around January, latter part of January. And then, so after we'd had these dogs about a couple of years, why, I got a pup, a female from the old soldiers' naval team that used to be up here in the early days, you see. And I got a pup from them, and I just turned right next to the wolf right around there, and finally I had one pup. One pup was a female, just as mean as could be, you know. You couldn't get near, it would just snap at you and everything. So I told Van, I said, I'm going to cross that back to the wolf. He said, you're crazy. He said, you can't handle that dog the way it is. I said, oh, I'm going to cross the back anyway. So I did. I let run in there with the wolves, you know, what we had there. And we tried to work the wolves, but they were no good in the sled. You know, they'd trot along, but they didn't have the endurance. And finally, I got one pup from this female pup that I had. I got one pup. And that turned out to be the best lead dog, best hunting dog I ever had, yeah, and a three-quarter wolf.
Oh, that's good.
And the best leader and best hunting dog I ever had, yeah. In fact, you can ask Eddie Hudson over here about that one, because I told him, I said, she was going to have some puppies, you know. I said, don't bother the pups. Don't touch the pups, whatever you do, if you kill them.
Okay.
Yeah, anybody else touch them. I could handle them, and he was all right, see. But if anybody else touched those pups, he would just snap the heads off each one of them like that, just kill them. Yeah. And so anyhow, I left her with him, with his dad, Cliff Hudson. And I said, if you need any caribou anytime, just tell her, go and get the caribou. Just talk to her like you would a kid. Go and get some caribou. And she'd bring caribou right down to me. She wouldn't run them, but she'd just kind of come along slow behind him like you're herding sheep, and the caribou would take off and come right in your direction. And you can get caribou that way, yeah. And his dad was going over the hill into Livengood from Olive Creek, where his mine, and he had the dog following along with him. And the dog took off. It was foggy then. It was real foggy up on that hill going over that dome. And here come a bunch of caribou bringing me to run him over. A few minutes after, here come the dog behind him. And he didn't pay any attention to it, and he kept on going over the hill. And that dog went right back again and brought them caribou towards him again, like that. Turned them around and brought them towards him. And he says, okay, he says, I have to call her Daisy. Okay, Daisy, we don't need any caribou. I'll give you some when we get in town. But he says that dog gave him the most disgusting look he ever saw, because he didn't get one of those caribou. No, you may. That's only one in a million to get a dog like that. I used to go and I'd shoot chickens, you know, and birds, you know, pintails. And I used to run to the tree, you know, and holler at her to get away from them, you know. Finally, I shot one, you know, in the stomach out way there, and it went way off in the nigger head and top. I said, that's yours, go get it. She went over and got that bird and brought it right over to me and dropped it right at my feet. And from then on, I never went, when I shot a bird, she'd go over and get it. I didn't have to train her on any of it.
In the big country, where a man travels his own trail a good bit of the time, his friends mean a lot, whether they are four-legged or the two-legged human kind. The characteristics of each individual stand out, and people get to be known by some unusual event in their lives or some unusual trait. And so you have Slow Pan Pete, Buckshot Joe, Skookum Charlie.
Then of Two-Step Louie, that danced away three fortunes learning to two-step. You see, he made one in Eldorado, he made one in Dawson. And he used to dress up as a young man, he'd dress up as a girl, one of these girls, you know, dance girls. And you ought to hear some of the stories he'd tell you about that, because he's passed away now. And all the good-looking girls, you know, and all the fellas wanted to dance, and they didn't know who he was at the time. This was in Dawson, you know. And when I met him over on Gnome Creek, that's on the other side of Chattanooga, where I stayed, and he used to tell me all those stories. And he's crazy to two-step. And he made a fortune in Nome, and he spent that fortune, you know, just learning how to two-step and dance. Yeah, and he's crazy about it. And then he made one out here in El Dorado, and he came into Fairbanks and danced that one way, basically. And two-stepping, you know, free, everybody come easy and spend money out there. And then and later on, there's an English outfit bought all his ground he had on Nome. Rather than giving a whole lump sum down, they give him so much, you know, to live off of. Whenever he got to his place, he had one of these old-time Victrolas, you know. One of those with a loud horn on, you know, like he used to have in the early days. And there was nothing but two steps on his record. And I come in there one time, just for the fun of it, I started this thing up. And he reached up and got the dish rag off the line and put it around there. Come on, he said. We started two-stepping, the door two-stepping right around there. I thought he was just a little fella. He was just like a chickadee, you know. He was awful like footy belly. I came along one day and he was laughing outside there to beat the band, you know, and I couldn't figure out what he was laughing at. But I heard a woodpecker on the stovepipe, you know, ping, 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 like that, and looked at it. I said, what are you laughing at? He said, you're going to get a slim worm out of that stovepipe, isn't he? Oh, some of their sayings.
Some of their sayings, yes. They're good for a laugh, but their stories, they're good for listening. And Bill Estor's stories about the early days are among the best. Today, the Sourdough Speak has brought the story of the founding of the mining camp of Livengood, about 80 miles from Fairbanks on the Elliott Highway. Gold was officially discovered at Livengood in 1914, and a few mines continue to operate. Among those people still mining there are Bill and Thelma Estor. In the next broadcast, we bring you a visit with Jeff Studdard. Jeff has been called Mr. Dog Musher himself, for Jeff is well known for his years of activity with the Fairbanks Dog Mushers Association. But Jeff's livelihood in Alaska has primarily been through the lumber business. In the next broadcast, the Sourdough Speak will visit with Jeff Studdard about Alaskan lumber camps and sawmills in interior Alaska, and discover the important role that this industry has played in the growth of Fairbanks. This is Neville Jacobs inviting you to join us for our next interview with a pioneer Alaskan in the Sourdough Speak.
You have been listening to The Sourdough Speak, a series of discussions about the history and development of interior Alaska in taped interviews with pioneer Alaskans. The Sourdough Speak was produced by Alaska Communication Arts in conjunction with the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services.